Today is Wednesday, May 2nd, 2007. My name is Sandy Thaler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Department Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Cynthia Jackowski, Professor of Physiology in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She is also affiliated with the UW-Madison Center for Neuroscience. Hello.
Hi.
We're going to start this interview by asking you if you would talk about your early life, where and when you were born, if you describe your childhood, your early schooling, talk about anybody in your life, your family, friends, teachers who might have influenced you on your career path.
Okay, I was born July 1st, 1957 in New York City, in Queens, in the borough of Queens. And I had two older sisters and a mom and dad, so we were a family of five. I went to school in parochial Catholic schools, so I went to initially for grammar school, first Our Lady of Fatima, but then another school, St. Joan of Arc, which we were raised Catholics, and these were Catholic schools mixed at this point. Boys and girls, and I can remember in my fourth and fifth grade teacher, her name was Mrs. Travier, and she was, that was the first time I got science classes that were, she was great, and we did science projects, and I remember building like what was happening under the sea was in building like continental drifts and also shelves and like and having all these projects, different science projects. So I would say she was one of the first people who really I liked science and I did well in it, and she really instilled this exploring. And then my dad was always very involved in us doing things. He had three daughters, but he instilled in us that school was very, very important, and that from a very early age we were told we were going to college no matter what.
What did your father do?
And so my father was a truck driver, and so my parents are first generation from Poland on both sides. Mm-hmm. And my grandparents on my father's side came over on a boat and went through Ellis Island, and they settled in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint, which was very Polish at that time. And they owned the deli, and my mother's family, who also came from Poland, different area in Poland, their last name was Brzezinski versus Jackowski, and they owned the candy store across the street. And so mom and dad met there. And so they both went to Polish school. Actually, they spoke Polish only until they were like in first or second grade. Huh. And they learned English once they started.
Now, did your mother work?
My mom didn't work. She stayed at, she was home with the kids. And my oldest sister is 7 years older than I am. And then my middle sister is 4 years older than I am. My mom had me when she was 30. And I can remember, my dad, he was a truck driver and delivered bread. It was called Silver Cup. It's sort of like Tasty, but it was based in New York City. So mm-hmm. it was called Silver Cup. And so he would get home at 3 or 4 o'clock and meet us after school.
Did he help you with your homework?
Oh, yeah. He helped us with our homework. And so that was really good. And they were both of them, unfortunately, we never learned Polish because they were very, I think that first generation gets really difficult about whether they want you to assimilate totally. Mm-hmm. And so it was very different than my generation now, where we're all trying to teach our kids another language at the same time. And but it was It was good when we lived in Queens. And
did you go to a parochial high school too?
And so then after grammar school, then I went to an all-girl Catholic high school. Yeah, St. Agnes Academic High School. And there are pluses and minuses to that. Looking back in the way back now, many years later, it's mostly pluses in that you were the focus. Like, you didn't worry about competing with other women to compete for men's attention kind of things. And the basketball team, the women's basketball team, wasn't sort of second fiddle to the men's basketball team and this and that. So in that way, it was great. It was small. Like, each class was about 200 students. Mm-hmm. It didn't have all the bells and whistles of some of the best high schools, public high schools in New York, like Bronx Science and a couple of other places. But at the same time, it did have a fair amount. I was in the math club and in the science club. I had some very good science teachers there and math teachers. I actually really loved math there. And I think they helped, because it was an all-women's school, it was, you didn't feel insecure about being good. Mm-hmm. At skills that in a lot of ways later on you would worry about being good at, mm-hmm. in that you were better than a guy or this and that. And so that was, in retrospect, that was actually a really great place, even though high school, no matter what anybody says, that whole age is like, who would ever want to like repeat that ever in their life?
True.
Never again. Because you kind of, it's awkward, you don't like yourself. But in retrospect, I think it gave me the sense of being very independent and feeling comfortable and being smart. Mm-hmm. And knowing these are the things I like and like to do. And I was valedictorian in my high school, and so I gave a little speech, that was kind of fun. And then from there went to NYU, to New York University.
And how did you choose that?
It was mostly financial reasons. Both my sisters had gone to St. Agnes, and so because we were 4 and 3 years separated, we were all, and one of my sisters skipped a grade, we were all every 4 years. None of us were there at the same time, but for a stretch of 12 years, they had a Chakowski there. And so they knew us well. And I won several scholarships, mm-hmm. to different schools. And both my sisters had gone to city colleges, to Hunter and also Queens College, which were a lot more financially feasible for my family. Mm-hmm. So I ended up getting a fairly substantial scholarship to New York University. So it was like, well, I could go to City College, or I could go to New York University, or I could go to St. John's University. So I ended up going to NYU. I liked the idea that it was in the Village and in Manhattan, and it was a very good school. And on league with sort of Ivy League schools. So I ended up going there, which I couldn't afford a dorm and stuff, mm-hmm. but there was a bunch of people who commuted, but that was fine.
Now, did you go with the idea that I'm going to be a scientist, or?
No, I went with the idea that I was going to, actually, as a fairly pretty young, I love Jacques Cousteau and all those shows and Animal Kingdom, I'm still a sucker for Animal Planet. I could get sucked into those shows really badly. I thought at probably like, I would tell people at, when I was 8 or 9 that I was going to be a mammalogist and study wolves. I was going to be the Jane Goodall of wolves. That was my, now here and now, like, if you look at what I do, I'm, you know, study a protein, and I'm, you know, a protein chemist. Like, as far removed from, like, behavior as you can get. But I'm still fascinated with that, and, like, I still follow up on wolves and animals and behavior and things. And I just said that's what I was going to do, and people were like, I don't know what 8-year-olds like.
Especially an 8-year-old from Queens.
Right. So I sort of morphed into, of course, as most people do as they go to college and stuff, who are interested in science, saying that, oh, I'll go to medical school. I'll be a doctor. And there was a lot of, not a lot of pressure, but there was definitely daughter be a doctor. Make sure you have to have a living. Da, 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 da. And so I took pre-med courses, and, you know, and it was a rude awakening. Like all of a sudden, like you're at. So I went from an all-girl Catholic high school in Queens to NYU in the village. So. And all of a sudden, you're not the smartest person, or even close to smart. You know, everybody, like, you're like, wow, these people are really smart. and then there were men, and so there was a huge distraction going on there initially, which was fun. It was great. It was a great time. But as I started going through classes, I did well, but. I did very well, but I was sort of like, not sure. And then I got involved with doing research as an undergraduate, which is something I love here at the UW, because there are lots of, I have always, in my own lab, I have a lot of usually undergrad, at least 1 to 2 undergraduates doing research in my lab. But I found a laboratory. I was taking a class, and I found a lab where I actually started doing research in my senior year, and realized that wow, this is it. And it was sort of I was a biology major and also an anthropology major. I was a double major, and my anthropology teacher was just like, well, are you going to continue? Do you want to go to Africa? Do you want to go do this dig? Da, 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 da.
Is that what the research was about?
Yeah, that was something totally different. Then I was doing neuroscience research in this other lab. Who could actually pay me? Because obviously the anthropology people couldn't pay you anything. And the neuroscience people over here who had funding from NIH and from other sources versus the anthropology NSF grant kind of thing, were actually giving me money to do some work. And so I loved doing anthropology. I loved studying it. I was really fascinated by it. And but for me to get to this dig, I had to pay for it. And there was no way in my family that I could get to Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of torn. And then I ended up just working more in this. It was a neuromuscular junction lab, really looking at development between neurons and the muscle, and doing EM and looking at effects of myasthenic syndromes and degeneration of that neuromuscular junction. And I was doing EM and looking at the pictures. Mostly I was tracing pictures and doing things as an undergraduate. But it was fascinating, and I really loved it. And it was a little different than now, which even in high school, there's a lot more pressure on people to know what they're doing, I think, now. Or, like, you know, I was in my senior year, and I was still, like, going, well, you know, I'm not applying to medical school, but, you know, what am I going to do?
Now, and why did that drop off, the medical school?
I'm not sure. I just didn't feel that I would, well, at that point, and that was 1979, it was incredibly competitive. And my grades were very good, but they weren't 4.0s. And so how committed was I really to do it? I didn't think I was all that committed, and what I always really liked was sort of this idea of doing research that I had been seeing all this time, but I hadn't spent a lot of time actually trying it out. So this little exposure at the end of my junior year, beginning of my senior year, sort of pushed me over. I went, oh, this is what I want to do. And so I applied very late to like graduate schools, because all of a sudden I'm like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be applying to graduate school.
Were there faculty at NYU that were helping you?
Just my Professor Gennaro, this is the person who was running this lab, and he was like, well, Cindy, like, apply to graduate school, but you're kind of late. Like, you know, it's like February.
February of your senior year.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I was like, yeah, I know. And I said, well, I could. He's like, but if you want. And at the time, I was actually teaching. I had almost finished all my classes, and I was also teaching in a small high school, very private high school in the village. I was teaching labs, chemistry labs and stuff. I was much older than some of these high school kids, but
there I was.
So I was mostly doing, I was doing that and then doing some lab work, because I had done most of my coursework. I had almost finished all my credits. And I was like, well, I could teach for a year. Because they said, yeah, you could stay and teach for the whole year. And they were paying really quite well. It was a very expensive private school. And but he was like, you know, I know some people, you know, in a couple of different places in, you know, in the city. And like, the beauty of living in New York City is that there's so many different institutions. It wasn't like I had a lot to choose from to still sort of figure out where to go to graduate school. And so he said, apply late to these places, and I'll just sort of make a phone call to the chair, because I know a couple, and to see what pans out. And what panned out was Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, and I ended up going there, and I thought I was going to work with the chair of the department who was doing muscle research, because I was sort of interested in like this neuromuscular junction and the degeneration of the muscle during this. And he was working on, his name was, Fishman, Donald Fishman. And he was working on different isoforms of this muscle, this protein that's found in muscle called myosin. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. This sounds kind of interesting. And so I got accepted into the program, and there I was. Lo and behold, I'm there. And then, but part of the program, which was very good, it was the anatomy and cell biology department. He had just become chair of the department pretty recently. And I started in his lab doing rotation and stuff, and I was like, oh, but they said, you know, you should do a couple of rotations just to make sure this is the right place. And I ended up in a really pretty young assistant professor's lab, David Farb, who was working on GABA receptors in neurons. And I did my rotation there, and it was like, I'm going to stay here, because this was what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of very weird how I got to where I am. I tell people in my lab, and I consider myself a neuroscientist. I like the idea of studying something that's going on in the brain, but basically I'm really interested in how proteins work. Specific proteins, signaling proteins, things that bind something and do something. I could see myself, if I sort of got onto a different path, maybe being a virologist who's studying how viruses like actually get in, because in many ways it's the same kind of story. But there I am, you know, I'm a neuroscientist, I study receptors. And so I spent a while in graduate school, though. You know, it took me a little bit of time. It took me 7 years to get through graduate school, which is a long time for a PhD. Partly, my first project didn't work, so 2.5 years down, I had to start all over again, which was a drag. Which was a bit of a drag, and you second-guess yourself along the way, and you're saying, is this the right path? And I think
now that experience has helped me a lot as a mentor, because I recognize that somewhere around year three, every graduate student has this crisis of like, I don't see the end in sight, and why am I doing here? And you have to sort of get them through that and just go, everyone has that. It's perfectly normal. It's okay. But in the end, I had a very productive graduate career. I had lots of papers. I think I did some significant work that was recognized as being significant. And it became my first love. I was working on what I work on now, GABA A receptors, and which are these neurotransmitter receptors found in the brain. And at the time, there were several breakthroughs that were occurring just because of molecular biology was exploding, and we were learning how to clone things and
do things. So this was in the things.
Early 80s? I graduated with my PhD in 1987. And so it was just at the heyday when things were just getting, in the kinds of proteins I was interested in were even just getting cloned and getting expressed and figuring out how we can now manipulate them in ways we never could before. I ended up deciding to go for my postdoctoral work. I ended up staying in New York. So I was I did all my training in New York City. I just moved from institution to institution and never moved. So I ended up going to Columbia University and working with Dr. Arthur Carlin, working on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. And I chose that because at the time, still at that time, the GABA receptor hadn't been cloned. The nicotinic acetylcholine receptor had been. And also, he was one of the world-renowned experts on doing protein chemistry to try to really figure out what are the moving parts of this protein. How does this protein really bind to this tiny little neurotransmitter or this chemical, the signaling chemical that's in your brain that then causes your neuron to fire, which is exactly how communication happens. The way your brain transfers information is by these little proteins in the membranes of neurons that are communicating with each other, opening and closing in response to these chemicals. Mm-hmm. And it's happening on an incredibly fast time scale. And I really wanted to understand on just this protein level, how did it work? How did this sort of nano machine, you could almost think of, take this tiny little signal of a chemical and transfer that into a pretty big motion that opens a hole in a membrane and allows ions or electricity, you could almost think of, to cross across upon it. Mm-hmm. And he was a great mentor. And my PhD advisor was very good. He was very savvy. He told me the beauty of spin, like how to make your research interesting.
Oh.
My two others.
There you go.
Which is a key point, and how to make it accessible to lay people.
Mm-hmm.
My postdoc advisor really instilled in me this the beauty of a really well controlled experiment.
How did you get connected with him?
He came to Downstate and gave a talk when I was probably maybe a fourth year student or fifth year. And I remember turning around to my friends and other graduate students and stuff, and turning and was like, I'm going to work with that guy. And they all went, yeah, right. So the guy's like, trust me, I'm going to work with him. And this is one thing about Arthur. He never had one of these huge mega labs. He's always had a smaller lab. And he believed very much, there are two different philosophies with postdoctoral training. And one is that you bring someone on to learn something totally new, and you let them go with it, and if they're smart, they'll figure it out, and you help them do that. It's a little slower for your research progress, because it's going to take time for that person to get up and running. The other sort of style is you bring in people who sort of know what they're doing, who can generate lots of things. And it might be a related field, but not quite the same, but you plug someone in who knows all the techniques. And those are just two different styles. He was definitely the former. And because I had no idea how to purify a protein or run a column. I was pretty much a cell biologist at that time, not a protein chemist, so I was like, whoa. And but he was incredibly willing. Like, I went up there and, you know, I had called or sent a letter to saying, you know, I was going to be graduating, I was really interested in his work. And he had me come up and then offered me the position. And I was like, huh. And I had interviewed in like Eric Kandel's lab, a couple of other very high profile places. And most places said, you know, if I wanted, but there was something about Arthur's approach, much smaller lab. He was more there that I decided to go to his lab. And I wanted to work on molecules at that level, more at the protein level, and try to figure out how this worked. So it was great. So I ended up going there, and Arthur, you know, he's a perfectionist, so, you know, you either got along with him pretty well or you didn't get along with him very well. There were people who were pretty successful in his lab and other people who were not as successful. I was, thank God, one of the former, more successful people, so that was, my relationship with him was very good. Mm-hmm. But again, I spent a long time in his lab too. I was a postdoc for, I guess, maybe 3 or 4 years, and then a scientist for 3 years. At the time, as I was going through this, I was going through a divorce, like in about year 4. And that was right around the time when I would have been probably maybe looking for jobs and stuff, and we both said, you know, it wasn't worth it. it was just better for me to stay at the time. Mm-hmm. And actually it was great because I sort of totally switched. I then started doing electrophysiology and more molecular work and brought that into his lab, which was just sort of starting out. And so I sort of did two very different projects. And that was incredibly successful. And I think it was the combination of learning and doing both those things that ended up me landing jobs.
Now, why did you leave? Was the scientist job a temporary, or could you have stayed there?
Well, a scientist job, it's an interesting sort of road where you have to decide and make a split. A scientist position, what's great is, in general, you don't have the pressure as an assistant professor or a professor where you're not expected to have to teach and to do some other things. You are expected, as you get up in the scientist track, to bring in money, to maybe write grants and stuff, but your really job is just science, purely doing science. And that's incredibly attractive. Like, the part about being a postdoc that's just great compared to being a graduate student is you really know what you're doing at this point. You're good at it. Mm-hmm. And you can just focus on the science. And it is really, really fun, those years. And you can just immerse yourself in that. And then all of a sudden you get thrown back into like being an assistant, you know. And so you ask me, what's the choice? But the independence, and I liked also partly teaching. I did do some teaching in graduate school. I was in the anatomy and cell biology, so we had to take gross anatomy with the medical students and take a lot of other courses with the medical students, and then you had to teach. And I had taught also when I was in the end of my undergraduate, I had taught and stuff, and there was part of me that enjoyed that. And then the other part was, you want to be the one who's calling the shots.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And it's an amazing job to be paid to think and to come up with ideas and get paid to, like, do it. You're like, oh, okay. So I think that's sort of, at the time, the idea of, like, other options, other things to do was, you didn't have that as much as you do now. Like, I think in graduate school now, we really try to focus on giving students ideas of, like, what else you can do with your PhD besides the sort of traditional or classical track of going and being a professor in a mm-hmm. research institution. So I was very, so by the time I was finishing up at Columbia, I was pretty sure I wanted to apply for assistant professorship in different places.
Apply?
I applied all over the country. Like, at that point, I didn't have any really geographical ties. I was single. I did pretty much stay away from the South, and I was from New York City, so I was kind of a snob and was really mostly applying to the coast, but my very good friend, and who was also doing a postdoc with me in Arthur's lab, was his desk was right across from my desk, and, you know, we're looking for science, and I'm like, oh, you know, the advertisements, and he's like, I'm like, oh, University of Wisconsin, Madison, he's like, oh, that's great, go there, just kind of, it's like, it's in the middle of nowhere. He's like, no, he said, it'd be good practice anyway, apply, just send out all your applications. So, I must have applied to maybe like 20 or 30 different schools. And I was very lucky. I got a lot of interviews. I had a lot of interviews, and, you know, Wisconsin called at the time. They wanted to interview. And so basically I applied because I knew it was a good school. I knew the department was good. At the time I applied, actually the department was the Department of Neurophysiology. Neurophysiology merged with first physiology maybe about 10 years ago. So when I was the last recruit, actually, for the Department of Neurophysiology here. So it was very funny. And so I actually had interviews at Columbia, Cornell, and two different departments in Cornell Medical Center. University of Miami in Florida, and University of Vermont, and none out on the West Coast. I applied all to the UC schools.
Nothing.
But in here, and University of Chicago. And it was a lot. I had a lot of interviews.
Yes.
And I had offers from many schools. So I was in a very good position because I could really sit and make a decision about where I wanted to go. And so I remember, though, initially when I was coming to the University of Wisconsin, Madison, I called and said, you know, is there an airport, or do I have to, like, fly from, like, do I have to drive from Milwaukee or Chicago? And they're like, oh my God, who is this woman coming from New York City? I was like, nice. They're like, no, you can fly here. And I was like, okay. And, it was a hard decision. I actually ended up being a really tough choice between here in Chicago and Cornell. I didn't want to stay at Columbia because Columbia eats their young. No, it's this interesting there are some really great schools for graduate school, for being an assistant professor, and there are great places to do postdocs and to be other people. It's sort of that nurturing quality versus, like, you know, at Columbia, and also Cornell, they sort of gave you the, here's your money, here's your space, and, you know, we'll see you in 4 years and make sure it happens. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. We're not really, and we're expecting you to do really good things, but we're not going to help you along the way, kind of thing. I got a very different feeling when I interviewed here. It was much more open. And partly it's like all the doors were open, all the labs were open, the buildings are open. It's more open just because it's a safer place in certain ways, but that's just the atmosphere. And the department was very, very good. I was really surprised at how many good people were here and how big it was. And I was really drawn. I had done all my training in medical schools that were separated from the main campus. They're all really small, where the graduate students made a really tiny minority of, like, the population. And the idea of being on a campus, a full campus, was really quite attractive. So then it ended up being between here and Chicago. And both were very good departments. Chicago felt very familiar for me because it was a big city. And I was like, oh, I could do this really pretty easily. And it was very funny when I was recruiting here. They were the chair of the department at the time, John Bruby, you know, the second visit, you know, they were trying to, and they were like, they didn't know I wasn't married or this and that. They were like just saying, well, Chicago is only like 2.5 hours away, and da da da. I was like, you got to do better than that, because basically, I'm getting an offer at Chicago. So And they're like, well, it's a great place to, you know, raise kids and stuff. And I said, and I'm single. So I was like, you've got to figure out another angle here. And what, to make a very long story short, I ended up coming here. And as I put it, as part of my startup package, the administrator of the department that I was being recruited to, my husband, Pat, was the administrator, and he's the one who actually, they put me up at the Mansion Hill Inn here, and he sort of orchestrated that on my third visit or something, and took me on a tour and everything, and I ended up coming here, and then later on we ended up dating and ended up getting married, and here we are. So I always joke that part of my startup package was not only the money, but my husband.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Doesn't matter that we're close to Chicago. Doesn't matter it's a nice place to raise kids, but we can get you a husband.
Husband, here you go. And I was like, oh my God. But, and so they went above board to try to recruit me. They did. I had one of the larger startup packages at the time from the med school.
So you had learned how to negotiate.
Oh, yeah. I had learned. Well, I was in the position to negotiate. Mm-hmm. I was in a very good position to negotiate because I had other offers. Right. If you don't have other offers, you're not in the position. Mm-hmm. I had other offers, and then I also had my really good friend Jonathan Javis, who was telling me how to do it. In New York, whose family was very, you know, and everybody was, you know, very business-oriented group, and most of all my friends went into, weren't scientists in New York, and they were all investment bankers and this and that. Oh. So everyone was going, okay, this is exactly what you say and how you do it. And just say, yeah, you understand that the cost of living is different, but money is money, and this is what, you know, okay. Chicago's this and this and that, and you need this, and you just stick to your guns. I was like, and they said, and it's not really that big of a difference, because you would be pretty happy going to either place. And I was like, yeah, pretty much. And they're like, just do it. So,
did it meet your expectations? Did the campus, yes, the department, everything was?
Working? They did everything that they said they were going to do for me. Mm-hmm. I think they didn't come up totally with my salary. I think they were off by like $5,000 or something like that. But they tried really, really hard. And basically, they couldn't make it any higher just because of what was going on in the at the level of medical school, because everyone has to be sort of at the same level, or else then they have to bring everyone up, and that would have just been, they just couldn't do it. And I believe them, and after coming here, I recognize that it was true. The space was fine, and they were and have been incredibly supportive. Like, I felt very taken care of.
Is it collaborative, the department?
I think the neurophysiology department was a small department. It was about 8 or 9 people and at the time. And then before my tenure decision, we merged, which was a little bit tricky because I was hired by another department, and like the chair of the physiology department was staying chair, but he didn't have any voice in my hire. And so that was a little worrisome. and also all these people are going to vote who didn't really hire me or, you know, vote on it. But pretty much everyone was on board, and I think the merger went, I think there have been a couple of little hiccups and things. Mm-hmm. As far as collaborative, yes, like I have joint papers with multiple people in the department. I think being in the department, I actually chose a physiology department because I wasn't a card-carrying physiologist. I was more of a protein chemist, but I recognized that we were trying to answer the same kinds of questions, and I needed these people. So now, scaredly, I do a lot of electrophysiology and less protein chemistry. Like, I think if I had been in a different department, I would have moved the other way. And I was recruited before I had tenure to Vanderbilt. I had seriously thought about it because the chair there was an incredibly dynamic woman that I would have really liked to have worked with, Lee Lindbergh. And there I would have moved into a much more structural place just because of the people around me. Bottom line is I just couldn't see myself living in Nashville. Like, if it was in another city, I could have maybe done it. I was like, I can't go here. So from Madison, it was a big transition going from New York City to here. But for a small city, it has a lot going on.
Well, talk about the tenure process.
The tenure process was tough. It's a little scary. And originally, you don't kind of realize how fast it's going to happen. Because, you know, they tell you it's 7 years, but it's really not 7 years at all, because one of those years are chopped off, because if you don't make it, they have to give you a year notice. So it's 6 years, and then to actually make it happen in 6 years, your package has to be sort of ready at like 5.5 or 5.25. It would have really been nice to have known that up front. But that timeline, like, I know I'm like chair some mentoring committees, and we have a timeline like that. Like, here you go. This is when it's going to happen. So you need those 5 papers here, which is at about year 4.5, 5. Your papers have to be almost like accepted and submitted, like, close. Because in, you know, is the magic number 5, if it's a science paper, is this or that, it could be somewhat different. And then you have to be getting grant money, because basically, at least in the med school, you know, my appointment is mostly research. Like, I'm getting tenure on research, and then excellence in research. It's research and then teaching and service, but mostly research. You have to be really good at teaching, but you're not innovating new teaching methods, let's just say. You're not getting tenure for doing that. So somewhere around year 3, 3.5, it dawned on me. I was like, oh my God. But I was doing fine. The department was always incredibly supportive. They were always like, you're going to do fine. You're doing fine. Everything's okay. They protected my time early on from a lot of teaching. I think women in general don't have as much protected time just because they need people to be on committees and right. other things, so you end up sopping up time doing that. But overall, I think, you know, they have these mentoring committees, and, you know, basically, you know, sometimes it was like, well, Cindy, you have to publish. And I was like, yeah, no kidding. Tell me something I don't know. You know, help me, like, figure out how to do it. I think, actually, what was incredibly helpful was very early on at the one of the initial faculty welcoming meetings or whatever, when you became a faculty person just on campus, I met a woman, Nancy Colley, who was brand new, an assistant professor also in ophthalmology, and she started organizing a women's sort of group of assistant professors that we still meet. Now none of us are assistant professors anymore. And there were some associate professors, but we were all going through it sort of within a year or two of each other process, and we would meet once a month, and we've been doing it now, I guess, for 14 years. So Ann Kelly is one of those people who's in this group, and so now we're just very good friends. You know, most of the time we don't talk science. We just talk about anything else we meet. But I think we do still touch on, like, you know, what are our problems, personnel problems, how to manage labs, how to get papers through. You know, it never dawned on me to, like, argue with the editor if my paper wasn't accepted. I think that group has been incredibly helpful to get through the tenure process. Mm-hmm. Having that support group. The medical school is trying to sort of implement that. I think it's hard to sort of force it to happen. I think if it sort of generates, but I do think having women in those roles to help other people, mm-hmm. mentoring people is important. I can now switch into this. So funding has been
interesting. That's a question I really wanted to talk about.
When I first started here, which was, now I'm trying to remember, 1994, funding was tight in NIH. Like, they were funding, the National Institute of Health was funding maybe at the 12th percentile. It was, you know, it was a little tight, maybe the 14th percentile, but it wasn't horrible. I have been funded, basically when I first started, I had a lot of smaller grants. I had a March of Dimes, Basil O'Connor Award for New Investigators, at a Burroughs Wellcome New Investigator Award. So I was pretty much, what was great about the department when I came is they identified many different fundings, these smaller foundations, and said, just go for it. And so I initially wrote many grants, but then all of a sudden I started getting hits, you know, and that was great. And so it was, you know, 25,000 here, 50,000 there, but it added up, and it also gave you a sense of understanding how to write the applications and getting it through. So once I got to the point where I was applying to NIH, I was feeling more confident. But my, you know, first try didn't get funded. And my second try, because the funding climate was pretty tight, even though it was like a 15th percentile, it didn't get funded. And I was like, oh my God, what can I do now? And finally, because I was a new investigator in council at the next level, and it was very interesting, the woman, Dorothy Penn, who was head of council, happened to be in the lab across from our lab from where I was a postdoc, and this is where networking counts. And I used to help her in, like, you know, when I was in Arthur's lab, occasionally she would come in and say, I need something, Cindy, could you, like, give me some material, da-da-da, and instead of having one of her techs or someone do it, I would just end up doing it and just give it to them, because it was simpler. And so she pulled my grant. She recognized me, pulled my grant up, and funded it, which was, it was within, it was close, it was a percentile point off. But, and at the same time, I was a new investigator, so they were trying to fund more of those grants. But I think partly it was she recognized who I was and pulled it out. And I was like, oh, it was the first lesson in realizing that part of this is actually, it's not where you're going to fund bad science or something, but it's also knowing and getting your story out there and really being a colleague with people is helpful. So I was like, oh, I should remember this. And since then, I've been continuously funded from NIH. I've had other grants from other foundations along the way. And more recently, I've been involved in a contract, which this is the first time I'm doing this, and it hasn't quite come through yet. Like, we haven't completely signed, both of us, but when I was at the biophysics meeting a year and a half ago, Sepracor, which makes Lunesta, the sleep aid, approached me about maybe doing work with them, which would be more what I work on, and now I can morph into that a little bit, but part of the research that I've been doing is at the UW, I went back to GABA-A receptors, and these are all the same proteins in the same family as what I did at my postdoc in that they bind neurotransmitter, and their job is to take that neurotransmitter, that chemical signal, and open a channel. What's interesting about these GABA-A receptors is that they control all the inhibition that's going on in the brain. So what they do is they quiet the brain and prevent overexcitation. And so mutations in these receptor leads to epilepsy in somewhere. And in addition, the receptor is a target of a ton of drugs that are used clinically. So one whole class of drugs are called benzodiazepines, where there's a site on this protein on the GABA A receptor which binds these drugs. And a common one that everyone would know would be Valium. But these sleep aids, Ambien and also Lunesta, also bind to that same site. And so this benzodiazepine binding site or this drug binding site, the drugs have very different structures, but they all sort of fit in there. And what they do is they don't control the opening and closing of the channel of the protein, but they just make GABA, the natural transmitter, work much better. So they augment the ability of this channel to work. And because this channel is important for inhibition to quiet the brain, they're really good at that. Then they help the brain, so that you get more bang for your money. So the same amount of GABA might be circulating in your brain, this natural transmitter, but now you take this drug and it makes it just even better. What's interesting is that, so right now, I had done some work on Ambien. I had published a couple of papers and not at all affiliated with any drug company. I was just very interested in how do these drugs with very different structures, like Valium looks very different than Ambien, but they both sort of dock into the same place. But I was interested in really defining that binding pocket, because we could really understand what that binding pocket looks like, we can make a much better drug. And so for the past few years, we've been working on that a little bit. One side of the lab, one part of the lab has been looking at that. And you know, we published a few papers, so they came in. So Ambien's direct competitor is Lunesta. the lunar moth. And so they came to me at this meeting and they just said, you know, would you be interested in coming and giving a talk and maybe, you know, and helping us out and consulting and this and that. And so I went and talked to them a little bit about what they were doing, and I talked about my stuff. And then they said, you know, we do give out grants and stuff to do, you know, sort of basic science research, and we would love for you to do what you did with Ambien, but with our drug. And just sort of when I was like, oh, we, you know, I was going to go down that road anyway. So basically, I think we might actually be getting some money from a drug company, which is, I had this in why it's sort of a mixed bag. It's like, you know, do you want to go down that road? And you know, do you have conflicts of interest or this and that? But the contract is written very broadly in that I have most, it's very basic science research. This is a really patentable kind of stuff, but they would like to know how their drug works better. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, we use these drugs, but do we really understand exactly what they're doing? No. So one whole part of my research program is trying to define these drug binding sites. And so other drugs that bind, besides this class of benzodiazepines, which would be Ambien and Valium, and those are volatile and intravenous anesthetics. Most of all, the clinical effects, like how they work, are due to their binding to this receptor that I'm studying. And also a lot of the effects of neuroactive steroids, metabolites of progesterone and estrogen work by binding here. In addition, many of the effects of alcohol, not all of them, but a lot of the effects of alcohol are mediated by its interaction. Mm-hmm. So in one way, we're interested in how drugs cause conformational changes or structural, how they make movements in the protein to make GABA work better. I'm kind of looking at it at that level, and then also how they just dock on. And it's sort of the opposite of what a drug company does, because a drug company keeps changing the structure of the drug. And what we do in my lab is we look at the protein and we tweak that structure, and we say, you know, what makes a drug bind better or worse, and what would be the ideal drug that would actually fit. So we're more working on this end than the other end. But they're both complementary, I would say. And so we're sort of working at that. And then the other whole part of what we're trying to understand is just basically how does GABA do it? You know, how does GABA make this thing open? And they're actually some of the really, I guess what my claim to fame is work that I did as a postdoc, where I actually defined that the way these natural transmitters or chemicals in the brain work, and not just GABA receptors, but in almost all this whole class of families, is that they bind, these proteins are made up of multiple parts, and there are five of these different parts that have to come together to make the channel. And what I found out is that this little chemical actually has to bridge between two of the parts of the protein, and it's that bridging at this interface that's key to how they work. And we're still sort of puzzling over that, working on that a little bit, and to understand how something very small could cause a really big conformational change. And the reason why that's important is that these proteins are so essential that many of the mutations of many different diseases are associated with mutations in these proteins. So part of what one graduate student has done in the laboratory is we really ended up trying to figure out the effect, what the effect of this mutation was. So in the human population, we knew this one amino acid, in the GABA receptor, just one, was mutated. But how did that result in the phenotype of epilepsy? And so what you can do now is we could, in a pure protein, we could just say, okay, we can make that mutation and see what does it do to the function of this protein. Does it affect the way GABA opens and closes the channel, or does it affect the way these five parts have to come together to form the channel, or does it affect how it gets into the membrane? And in a really nice set of experiments, this Faiza Sankar, who just finished her PhD, she described that the mutation's effect was really a trafficking problem. It was an assembly and trafficking problem. Like, the mutation caused the five parts not to come together very well or get to the surface. So then you just had less GABA receptors. With less GABA receptors, you had less inhibition, more firing. There you go. It has to be repeated in a neuronal cell background and in mice and with this mutation in this, but it tells you that you can go through these kinds of mechanisms and sort of learn how the protein's working, because those mutations was also pinpointing to us what are the essential parts of the protein. Because all of a sudden, if you realize that they all map to a certain portion, that points you to an important part of the protein. So that's the other part of what we've been doing. So the big, question is, how does signaling occur in the brain? And this is one of the major signaling proteins. And so we're trying to understand it at a level of not a circuit, but just how this one tiny piece works in that, and then fill that in.
You've touched, I think, on some significant developments in what's happened, at least since you've started working with these proteins. Are there other significant developments in your field?
I think crystallization, understand, we've gotten to the point where these proteins are embedded in the membrane. And that's been very hard to try to get a really good picture of, to actually crystallize something to the point where you could see every atom. Soluble enzymes and some other are much easier to do. So we've always sort of been working in the dark. We kind of know a little bit. These structures are now just coming out. We're getting breakthroughs in that, where we're understanding how these membrane proteins per se can look. I think that's taking us to the next level. I also think mapping the genome, the human genome, is really pushing us to the next level, because now it's not just cloning things. I remember as a graduate student, monoclonal antibodies were a big thing, and just making one would be a paper. And now it's cloning something in the 80s and 90s was a paper, and now we don't even have cloning, So I think where we are now is we have the book, let's just say. We have the code, but now we don't understand how they're put together. How does this protein signal to that protein? What's the significance of a pathway? Because now we don't even know what most of those proteins do, that we now have this code for. We're at the point where you need protein chemists and other things to just say, what does this do? And so these omic words, which I can't stand like genomics and proteomics approach and yeah, systems biology. In some ways, this is traditional physiology. It's trying to understand how the system works, or the whole thing works together, and how it changes in response to a stimulus of some kind. I do think that we're at the crossroads where we can begin asking some bigger questions. I think the field of neuroscience, where we are beginning to really, we have no idea how the brain works still, but we're at a level where we're getting closer to figuring out some small circuits and small ideas, like whether you want to call it consciousness or just some of the molecular substrates of memory. Whether that's the whole story, I don't think so. But I think we're at a better place to have to move things, at least at a level for society, where more medicine that's really more geared for the individual, individualized medicine, will be something that will probably happen more in the next probably 20 to 40 years, where people are going to be mapped for specifically what kind of cancer you have or what kind of, what exactly kind of drug would work best for you, and then maybe someone else. That will be very expensive though, so we'll end up, how that is, would all get paid out, I'm not sure. But that's sort of where I see the biggest things that have happened. And staying on top of that and changing is always the challenge. It's like you need to reinvent yourself. Like right now I'm going through that where I feel that I need to do something else, do something new, or I need a new approach. And I think that happens. And I think the successful scientists do it. And they recognize that. And so that's the beauty of the job, is that you're constantly learning. You're constantly forcing yourself to be on the edge of what you know. And that's good and bad, because you always feel kind of not very smart.
Well, you're constantly learning and you're constantly teaching. Would you talk about your teaching responsibilities?
Sure. I mostly am responsible and teach in a graduate level course, which is cell and molecular neuroscience. I've been doing that now, I'd probably say, for 12 years. And that's a every year fall course, and I teach, it's team taught. There are like four major people teaching, and the class has gotten bigger and bigger every year. We now have like 40 or 50 people in it, which is a lot for a graduate level course. There's always a couple few undergraduates in the class, but it's become quite popular. But it sort of changes the venue a little bit. I also do some teaching in pharmacology in a graduate level course. Medical school teaching, I mostly have taught small groups in the first year medical physiology class, where they do excitable membranes and stuff, and we have small groups with faculty. So there you'll be meeting with, you know, maybe 20 to 30 students a couple of times a week, going over problem sets and questions and things from lectures. And that's pretty good. A lot of my teaching is with undergraduates. All my teaching has been mostly just students doing senior thesis in my lab or research in my lab, research credits. And that's been incredibly successful. A lot of my students have won awards and have gone on to graduate school or medical school. Many of them are authors on papers, co-authors on papers, or have abstracts and things. So that's been actually really a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And am I missing anything? And then it's just mostly the graduate level training.
Yeah, talk about that. Do you have postdocs in your lab too?
Yes, I have.
What's it like working with graduate students and postdocs?
The graduate student training is great. I love graduate student training. It's great to watch them go when they all of a sudden just really get it. And right now I'm in the midst of graduating a bunch of students. And so one student just graduated in January, Faiza Sankar, and another student, Jose Mercado, is graduating in August. We've set his date. And I'll have another student, Shri, graduating, I bet, by January. So when you see them in that last year just become a colleague, like where they're questioning you, where they're coming up with their own ideas, where they're truly excited about what they're doing and needing to go and do something else, you know that, wow, like, hey, and they went from someone who was kind of scared and didn't really recognize all the controls and their experiments didn't work and they were like, oh my God, this is never going to end. And they were smart, but you know, you were trying to wonder, like, why did you do the same experiment 7 times in a row when it wasn't working? You go, what? I take it pretty seriously. I spend a fair amount of time with my graduate students. I try to meet with them at least once a week, each of them privately. We have lab meetings then.
Do you have to teach them how to write?
Yeah, that's really hard. And I am a good writer, but a really slow writer. And my writing doesn't come easily. And it's coming even less easily now. And I think it's been hard for me to actually teach that. I think we do it by the way I was taught, and both my mentors pretty much, I would give them a draft and they would give it back all read. Then I would give them back a draft and then they would give it back. That was my PhD advisor, who was an excellent writer, excellent command in English. Arthur did it very differently, in which I've tried this. He made you sit in his office with him, and you wrote. He wrote, and you watched, and then he would reanalyze all your data, and you had to have all your lab notebooks there, and you would go talk about it, and then he would write. And then you would say, well, I really don't like that sentence, and he would ask you why. And so that could be torture, though. That was that. But at the same time, you really, there's something about that that I think I learned a lot. But I realized, I try to give them tricks about how to organize and I call it spin, and it sounds sort of like kind of flashy and stuff. But it's really important to be able to tell people why it's interesting. And it's the difference between sometimes getting very, very good work in one tier journal versus another tier journal. And nowadays with the internet and stuff, everyone reads most everything, but still for tenure decisions, for funding decisions, for this and this and that, and it's not always appropriate, but they do. You know, where you're publishing is important, and that you are publishing. So I think it's been very hard to try and figure out how to help people. But most of them, I think, get it by the time they're finishing. Like we were just working on neuroscience abstracts for a meeting. And the more senior students were giving me abstracts that were really pretty good. I was just like, wow. I was like, okay. And in the postdoc was fantastic. I have a fairly new postdoc who's just great. I'm just like, oh my God, she knows how to write. And and postdocs are different kind of mentoring than graduate students. Graduate students, you really need to sit there and help them get through it and organize them and go through the scientific process. Like, really teach them the scientific process and reading critically and understanding the literature and what's an interesting question, how to answer the question, how to do a controlled experiment, what do you need to answer that question? Like, you know, not just this experiment, but this. Postdocs, you're just sort of trying to direct into a interesting area so they can make their splash and just say, here you go, and you could learn some new tricks and this and that, and I'll help you along the way, but and I'll give you my advice, but you kind of let them do it on your own, and you help promote them. Like, it's really important at meetings and stuff to make sure you are making sure they're meeting the right people and getting connected. Mm-hmm. So you try to do that, and it's my responsibility to help them find jobs and things. Mm-hmm. So you want them to be successful.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. And would you talk about your service activities that you've had over the years, the ones that you thought were actually worth your time and effort, and others that which you would never do again?
Oh, that's bad. That's a loaded question.
Oh, I don't mean it to be.
No, I've been on a fair amount of different committees on campus, and now I was on the graduate research committee. That committee was a good committee. That's where money from WARF, from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, where investigators across campus, not just from the medical school, but from all across campus, could apply for grants, small grants, not big, for research. And part of it can be money to help out between grants, other larger grants and things. And I was on the graduate research committee for 3 years where we reviewed grants. And what was great was that you actually went and visited different people on campus. And I was always assigned people not in the medical school and stuff. So you actually got a kind of broader view of what was going on campus, and you met some really, really smart people. I was like, wow, I had no idea this was going on. And so that was great, and you really felt that your input was important in using resources on campus. And so that level of, it was a huge commitment though. Like, it was a lot of work, a lot of committees, and like actually going and talking to people, reviewing the grants, writing up little reviews. It was like a mini NIH kind of study section. I was on NIH studies, this is more on a national level. I've been on National Institute of Health study sections for over 5 or 6 years. That's a huge commitment. It's very important that people are doing it, but it was, you know, 3 times a year traveling to NIH and then reviewing these grants, which inevitably, it took me 2 weeks each time. So that's 6 weeks right there of just total devotion to these grants. And so, but that was very scholarly. It was probably like 2 years too long. the process made me a much better grant writer. It really does keep you on the edge of what's going on in the field. And I did a lot of reading. You feel like it was a scholarly endeavor. And so in that way, I do think it's worthwhile. I just think either if they could kind of make it 2 times a year versus a commitment of 3 times of going to every single one. And the 5 years was just definitely 1 year too long and maybe 2 years too long. but I thought that was actually really quite good. I've been involved in faculty, I'm on search committees for faculty, and mm-hmm. that I think has been pretty positive. I was just on a search committee for the chair of the anesthesiology department, and that was interesting, being a basic scientist, being on a chair of a clinical, being on a search for a clinical department. It sort of was eye-opening. But that again, I thought was actually was good. More recently, I'm on the Merck committee, the Medical Education Research Council, which is where some of the money from the Blue Cross Blue Shield is getting decided. That's a mixed bag. That's about all I'll say. I think it's an important committee. I think it's an important committee. I don't know how effective I've been on this committee, or how effective I can be on the committee. Mm-hmm. And so then it's sort of one of those plus minuses. Mm-hmm. I was acting chair a year ago of the neuroscience training program, a graduate training program, with about 50 students and 80 faculty. That was really interesting. It was a fair amount of work. Actually, Ann Kelly was on sabbatical. She had been chair for many years. It was on sabbatical, and I took it off her for a year. And now, actually, Tom Yin is now chair. So I was just acting chair. But it was good. That was good. But that's one of those thankless jobs. Like, someone has to do it. You have to do a good job. But partly, I'm very committed to graduate education. So I felt that was a good place for my time. And those are most of the committees I've been involved with.
Would you talk about the climate for women on the Madison campus? Do you think it helps or hinders the advancement of women?
I think it's, I don't know whether I could talk about the Madison campus per se, because I think it's more it's more departmental. I see more of differences at the department level. That so as a whole, do I think the University of Wisconsin is doing a good job? No, not great. Do I think my particular department is great and fine? I think I've advanced, and I think the climate has been very good for women to advance. But I don't see that across the board. And are there things? I think the new dean of the medical school is quite aware of it. It's interesting. Like, once you get to higher levels of administration, there are not that many women, and you try to figure out why. and it's not like there are not some women professors or other things. And then you go back and forth about is there enough time to do everything? And how many women have gotten burnt out by being on so many committees before they got to the point where they could be in a different kind of leadership position, which might be a better position than doing all this other committee work. Mm-hmm. So, I think there's some room. I think there's definitely room on campus to move women into more positions and to make it easier, the climate easier. I still think that it's hard to recruit really good women.
Is it hard for you in your department?
I don't think we have ever overtly not said, like, oh, we're not going to recruit women or anything like that. It's just actually getting really qualified women do, like, especially in this last search, when we were searching for this chair of anesthesiology, you know, we're looking for a chair of anesthesiology who is, you know, a clinician researcher. How many women are out there? You know, we were banging down the bushes to get them to apply. You know, there weren't even that many men who were out there. You know, so, you know, you go, oh, okay. But I do think that there are some things that have to be taken into account that is really hard to do on paper when you're reading, like, someone's CV about, well, you know, why is this woman in her postdoc for 7 years and only has 4 papers, and this guy has 10 papers, it was, you know, mm-hmm. 4 years, but, you know, you don't know that she's had 2 kids and da-da-da-da-da in the meantime. And do you count that or not? And how do you count it? And how do you know that? And those are hard questions. And I think science right now is trying to juggle with that just overall on why are women leaving? And right now funding is very, very tight. It's like, you know, my graduate students are a little depressed, and even I'm a little anxious. Just, I have a grant that got a 16th percentile and it's not getting funded because they're funding at 9. And so, like, a year ago, a year and a half ago, it would have been funded, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I just feel like, okay, we're just going to have to go in a couple of times and this and that. But in the meantime, there are, you know, people like scientists in your lab and technicians. You have people with families who are, you know, working with you and are, you know, you're running like a small business and you're like going, wow, I'm not sure whether this is going to really pan out. I think some women are opting for other, are thinking about that.
I'm gonna switch gears again.
Sure.
Are you involved in professional associations and societies? And if so, how, what is your involvement? And do you think that that's important to your career? And if so, why?
I'm involved in just the Society for Neuroscience and also a pharmacology society. And I have been in the Biophysical Society. And most of those are all for scientific reasons. I go to these conferences, talk about our research, present our data, meet people, talk to people.
So it is important.
It's very important. Actually, we were having this discussion in my lab today with my students, because they were all trying to write abstracts for this meeting that's going to be in San Diego. One, it's in San Diego, and they're all like, yeah. And two, I was telling them I wanted them, as they put in their like abstracts and stuff, to sort of say that we wanted to present in a block, like they're all gonna have posters and stuff, but I said, you know, I want you to say you wanna be in the same session as everybody else in the lab. One, it makes it much easier for me. And now that I have a 2-year-old, like, I can't go for that long to a meeting, so if they're all on the same day. But at the same time, I said, you'll gather a group of people that are just interested in the lab, that want to see what's coming out from our lab. And then you just sort of draw them in. And I said, so you end up having a little constant crowd so that there's always people around versus just one isolated person. And I said, and I seem to think that works better at these really large meetings. In smaller meetings, you don't need that. But in larger meetings, which these are, you need something like that. I tend to try to bring my students to at least one big meeting a year, and then a couple of more senior people, I'll have them go with me to a more smaller meeting.
Would you talk about awards and honors that you've received throughout your career?
I guess so.
You mentioned some.
Okay. Throughout my career. Okay. There are a couple that I was actually. So the Burroughs Welcome New Investigator Award is actually really quite a. That was quite a coup in pharmacology. So that was one of the first ones that I won when I was here. Also the Basil O'Connor March of Dimes Award was another new investigator award that's highly competitive, and that was really nice to receive. And the more recent award was I received the College de France Distinguished Lecturer. And I ended up in the spring of 94 going to the College de France and giving a lecture, and they awarded me this big bronze medal. That's one of the oldest colleges in France. So, and that was kind of nice. And so those are some of the. That's about it. I haven't really, nothing else.
Well, now we come to the final questions in the interview, and this has to do with life after work. If you would talk about your family life, what you do for fun and relaxation, how do you stay healthy?
Good question.
How do you balance your work and family?
A struggle. it's very different right now. I went through tenure, and being partially single and married, but without children, and I didn't have Anne, my two-year-old, until I was 47. And so basically, that's very unusual. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but I sort of did it very different, and essentially my husband and I, didn't get married until I was here in my late 30s, 40s, and then we tried and just didn't think we were going to ever have kids, so we were sort of on the early retirement mode, and I did a lot of traveling and worked really, really hard and put in really long hours, and you know, generally the day was, we went to work at like, I was at work by 8 and worked until like 7:30, and then we had dinner and I did it again, and I worked part of the time on the weekends. Paris in springtime, College of France, there you go. There you go. Paris in spring. 9 months later, Anne was born. That has dramatically changed things. I do have a hard time trying to. I'm still, I think, learning how to. She's 2 1/4 or 2 1/2. I'm still learning how to juggle this, because now, basically, you know, I took 3 months off, and my husband took 3 months off, and then we went back to work, and all of a sudden I was working like, you know, 8:30 to 5:30, Monday through Friday, and trying to fit everything in. after she goes to bed, you work, and so now, like, before, free time was, we traveled, we went out, I biked, I hiked, I kayaked, we went canoeing, I did lots of things. Now I run after a 2-year-old, and that's great. I really don't want to miss, you know, I waited this long, and you know, it's a miracle that I had a baby and she's fine. That I am in a good position. My lab is very.
This is chasing after a 2-year-old. And your lab is well established.
Right.
Right.
I was going back to a point I made earlier was that I felt like I needed, it was time to sort of reinvent myself, to do something new. Mm-hmm. I think if, you know, before Anne, I think I would be there now. Like, I think I probably would have reinvented myself by now, or moved in a little bit of a different direction and taken a lab somewhere else. There's a part of me that's frustrated right now in that I feel that we've become a little stale. And partially I'm worried about grant renewals and stuff because we're not maybe at the edge. But at the same time, we are doing some cool things, and we have some things in my back pocket that I think are working. And I think I'm right now, everything seems to be clicking. And so it's good. And I would say we spend most of our time playing with the 2.5-year-old and going to visit grandparents with her and spending time running around, going to the zoo. I know the zoo in Madison really well. We go to Chicago, and it's been great. It has been a miracle, and that's really fun. Juggling is hard. Like, I don't know, and I have colleagues who've done it, I don't quite know how you do it when you're going through tenure. I am amazed. Or else you don't enjoy it as much. Like, I think I really do enjoy, I enjoyed her infancy, I've enjoyed her toddling. I think I've said that this is important and I'm just gonna do it. I've gotten better at prioritizing. I've gotten better at not being as much of a perfectionist. Mm. Okay, this isn't as good a job as I could do, but it'll be fine. This will work, and that's good. That's all I can say.
Are your parents still living?
Yes.
Actually, in New York?
No, they moved. So my oldest sister is a clinical psychologist. She has a PhD in psychology, and she did her work out in Salt Lake City. And so when I moved here to Wisconsin, my dad was pretty much retiring and stuff, and they ended up moving then out to Salt Lake City because my sister's kids were pretty small at the time. And my middle sister is a lawyer, and she's still in New York, and her kids are pretty, she had her children the earliest, like she had her kids when she was like 19, really young, and then she had her kids and then went to law school. She sort of did it opposite. So she, her kids were sort of grown up, so my parents sort of moved out towards the kids. So my parents are in Salt Lake City with one of my sisters, and my other sister's out in New York still.
And you get to see them periodically?
We're leaving on Friday to go to Salt Lake City.
Nice.
Because we haven't seen my parents since August, so they're chomping on the bit to see Anne.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a bit of a little vacation, and then I'm giving a talk in California. So I'm going to fly out to California from there. And Anne and Pat are going to come with me, and he has family in California, so they'll visit when I do my talk thing.
Well, we've come to the end of the interview.
Great.
I don't want to turn the tape off, though, if there's something that you'd like to say that we haven't covered yet.
I don't think so. I think I spoke way too much.
Oh no, this was an excellent interview, and I thank you very much for
taking
the time.
Oh, I thank you very much, too.
Great.